the shooter. Who child is time to juggle it too wild? That's why we got more than two styles. It's too adept in the situation, too shy. And though the road is rocky, I'm ready to try. The next mile to bring sight to the blind man. It's down to the left child. We will survive. And it's time to pull the next. Swimming through the waters of Babylon like a rebel fish. Jungleist, specialist, predator and survivalist. Spitting heaven, fire from his lips. Burn the same driver.
Welcome, listeners, to time for an awakening on Black Talk Radio Network, new media for the new millennia. This is a history and the current events program from a cultural perspective. We find this program necessary because Hosea 4:6 states, "My people are destroyed for the lack of knowledge." But we as a people can turn this around. Proverbs 4:7 states, "Wisdom is the principal thing. Therefore, get wisdom. And with all thy getting, get an understanding." Again, welcome to the program this evening with your hosts, Brother Elliot and Brother Richard. The number to reach us to join the conversation this evening is 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. We're streaming live at several locations. You can go to timeforanawakening.com, which is the homepage, and catch the live stream from that location. You can go to www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. Again, that's www.blacktalkradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening and catch the live stream there also. You can go to ourradionetwork.com. Again, that's ourradionetwork.com/timeforanawakening. They broadcast out of the Black Belt and catch the live stream there. Or you can download TuneIn to any of your handheld devices. TuneIn is a free app. And in that TuneIn search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening. There you'll see the icon and you can stream the program live, even into your car if you have the Bluetooth capabilities or the auxiliary connection. Again, that's Time for an Awakening radio program with the live stream on the TuneIn app. Drop us an email at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Again, that's timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Time for Awakening also has a fan page on Facebook. In that Facebook search engine, just type in Time for an Awakening radio program. There you'll always see interesting content being posted daily. And do me a favor, before you leave that page, just hit that like button. That's Time for an Awakening radio program with the fan page on Facebook, and Time for Awakening Media. The homepage is there. Always with the latest podcasts of the various programs on Time for an Awakening and interesting articles that you can download, read at later times, or even share with your friends. So make that one of your favorites. Put that in your address bar. That's timeforanawakening.com. Timeforanawakening.com will take you straight to Time for an Awakening Media. Tonight we have a special guest joining us this hour, probably the first half hour of the program, activist and organizer of Black Voters Matter, the co-founder, Brother Cliff Albright, will be joining us this evening in conversation to kind of continue the discussion we've been having maybe the past three or four programs consistently dealing with the advent of organizing our people. And if they want to participate in this electoral process, doing it the proper way. And we're going to talk with Brother Albright about what his organization has been doing in reference to organizing our people. Again, he'll be joining us within the first half hour of the program. But we'll be right back to get things started. And then we'll do a little brief recap of the panel discussion part two that we had here in Philadelphia at the Arteola's restaurant yesterday. Interesting gathering, panel discussion, and Brother Khalid Raheem was there presenting. But we'll be right back to get the program started. That's a brief word from our sponsors.
Mr. Moderator, our distinguished guests, brothers and sisters, our friends and our enemies. Everybody is here.
You are listening to Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasts or live programming, hit them up at timeforanawakening.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African-American owned and operated insurance agency and business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley. Dooley Brothers, specializing in shingle, rubber roofs, gutters, downspouts, and vinyl sidings. Call for your free estimate today. 215-224-3882. That's 215-224-3882. Dooley Brothers Roofing, the roofing experts you can trust. That number again, 215-224-3882. 215-224-3882. Before your roof becomes unruly, call Dooley.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
Overworked? Suffering with an underperforming company, headache customer, staff, or vendors? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? We turned a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one transformation created for entrepreneurs like you in various industries around the country. Not what you're used to from accounting and business consulting? Well, welcome to New Business Solutions. If you're ready to go beyond advising, coaching, and training and get implemented results, call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions apply the best comprehensive administrative, accounting, operations, human resources, management, sales, and marketing to help you actualize your vision for yourself and your company. From anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072. Spelled new as in numerous on your device right now. Book your free consultation at newbusinesssolutions.com.
History is a clock that people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
From antiquity to the present, our people need to develop a new paradigm. It's time for an awakening. With your host, Brother Elliot. Sundays, 7 p.m., Fridays at 8 p.m. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit us up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com. Welcome back to Time for an Awakening. And before we get started with our program this evening, I want to welcome in my co-hosts, Philadelphia activist and tour guide at the African American Museum in Philadelphia, at 7th and R Street. Brother Richard is with us. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir, Brother Elliot.
How are you, sir?
I'm not doing bad at all. I'm looking forward to our continuing dialogue and also the recap. You know, it's I think it's important to kind of go over and see what we picked up as we continue to develop this idea or this process, really, isn't it, Elliot? You know, around the necessity of engaging in politics, electoral and internal.
You know, it was interesting discussion yesterday, and as I stated before, our special guest this evening will be joining us around 7:30, activist organizer of Black Voters Matter, the co-founder, Brother Cliff Albright, will be joining us to continue this dialogue on this important topic. yesterday, Richard, as you and you were there. In fact, you were kind of torn between a couple of things that you had organized Saturday. You, Richard, I got to give it to you, man. You wear about 10 hats. I don't know how you do it.
But I don't even want to put it out there like that, because we all working together. We just make, you know, just doing different things at different times. But it was interesting, but I did learn a lot. And it goes towards this whole thing of what is politics and what is politics in our own self-interest, right? It has a lot of different dimensions to it that we have to work from.
Well, I mean, yesterday was part two of the initial dialogue that Time for an Awakening had started in October here in Philadelphia at MOTEP Charter High School. A think tank, as you so to speak, of sisters and brothers, activists here in the city of Philadelphia. And it's centered around the need and the premise. Or the synopsis was 50 years of Black political representation in Philadelphia. Now is the time for African-American grassroots or African-centered political agenda. The presenter yesterday was Brother Khalid Rahim of the New African Independence Party out of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Great presentation. Gave the people a lot of information on what was going on. In general, Richard, the audience that we had was unaware of any type of independent African-centered party that existed in Pennsylvania. They were basically aware of just Democrat and Republican. Some of them had been independent at one time or another. I think Brother Leon Williams, a prominent attorney who was on the panel, ran as independent a couple of times for DA. But they were unaware that it was a Black independent party in Pennsylvania that was registered and functioning. A lot of information was shared. The panel and audience got to ask some questions. The time, you know, when you're going over these things that people are unaware of and dispensing information, Richard, the time really gets by. I mean, it was slated for 1 to 4 and we ran over. I want to thank Mama Adiola and her husband for the use of their restaurant. You know, the people got to eat wonderful, healthy food and to participate in the discussion, hear information, get information after the program was over that they could take home, that they could study and get involved. I think I spoke with Brother Khalid before he left town and stated that several folks had joined the organization, joined the party before he left. So this will be a continuing discussion that we're going to have. Like I mentioned to the audience before on Time for Awakening, we've had other folks on the program that have functioning independent Black parties across the country, the Black is Back Coalition, the Zaki Baruti's organization out of Ferguson, Missouri, the New African, but Zaki Baruti's organization out of Ferguson, Missouri, 1 million Conscious Black Voters and Contributors. It's the Jackson Cooperative with Kelly Okuna that spawned Chokwe Lumumba and Chokwe Antar Lumumba. So it's a lot of folks that have been on this discussion need to move forward and continue, especially on this discussion centered around our 400 years of being here in this country and what we do from this point to move our people forward.
You know, Elliot, if I can go back to the point of Mama Teola and the restaurant and the political education process, you know, when you talk about politics, I think it's important for us to see here we are in a Black business and we're talking about politics and the mechanics of it. And isn't when we do politics correctly in our own best interest. And this, that was a microcosm, right? Because people came out and she provided the opportunity that we can be able to, while she's running. So it was a information avenue for her audience to become political, or her customers to become politically informed about a independent Black political party in Pennsylvania, while they enjoying, you know, the food that they're having, plus inviting other guests. So you're kind of like supporting a Black business. You're doing political education, and you're helping that whole thing of exchange of not just dollars, but information. Is that the model of what our politics is supposed to be about? I just thought that was something we need to let the listening audience be aware. That's how we're supposed to be in a cooperative kind of fashion of being able to educate ourselves on the politics, moving towards power, political power, and economic power.
Before we move on and continue the discussion, we're going to bring our guest on, Mr. Cliff Albright. I guess in about another 9 minutes. I want to read these community announcements. Two of the panelists that we had on have events coming up next week here in Philadelphia. And, that, you know, not disparaging any of our people, because we need as many of our people on board as possible. And I love to use that example that Sister Cynthia McKinney gives. But the reason, Richard, we both agreed to have activists on the panel is we wanted the people that was on the panel to have a track record of working constantly in the community. Mm-hmm. And both old and young, both men and women, are part of the panel. Two of them are having events next week in Philadelphia, and I want to read Sister Fillet, the organizer of the first Million Woman March in Philadelphia that garnered over 2 million people. She's still out here, still active, and still organizing. She has a function here, and let me read it. Philly Black Communities United, the Unapologetically Black Action and Grassroots Network will hold a briefing and organizing meeting on February 6th, 2019, for the upcoming We the People United Social Forum, coming July 2019 in Philly, as a part of the We Charge Genocide 21 Project, Black Human Rights Summit, and United States Initiative. Also, the Free Mumia Now Symposiums and Political Prisoners Teach-Ins and Speak-Outs as a part of the ongoing necessary work to fight for the freedom of our political prisoners, and specifically at this time that Mumia Abu-Jamal's Earth Day commemoration is taking place in April 2019. All interested persons are welcome to join on Wednesday, February 6, 2019, 5:30 to 6:30 at Atiola Spirit First Foods Cafe, located at 310 South 48th Street in Philadelphia. Special note, the Human Rights We Charge Genocide meeting is from 6:30 to 8:30. So that Sister Empress Fillet's event is on Wednesday, February 6th, at the same restaurant, Atiola's Spirit First Foods, at 310 South 48th Street. The third annual, and this is another event by Brother Omawali Africa, who was on the program, I guess, about a month ago. the treasurer of Afrocentricity International. They're holding the third annual PBHC conference scheduled, the African-Centered Education and History and the Practices of Liberation Pedagogy event. The key speaker is Dr. Greg Carr. It's February the 9th, 2019 at Mastery Charter School, the Shoemaker Campus at 5301 Media Street in Philadelphia, 19131. The time is 8 a.m. to 4 p.m. They have check-in with Continental Breakfast. The program opens at 9 with the introduction from the keynote speaker. The keynote speaker, Dr. Greg Carr, will be presenting from 9:30 to 10:15 a.m. The morning panel starts at 10:30 with Rites of Passage, African-Centered Education, presented by Ira Bond, The Role of African-Centered Education in Post-Literate Society, presented by one of our panelists, Omawali Africa, Using African History to Liberate and Empower, by Dr. Ayo Gooden, Education for Liberation, Centering the Life Work of New Africa Political Prisoners in the Africana Studies Classrooms, by Dr. Kanjana Kalita, and The Future of African-Centered Education, by one of our other guests, and that was a panelist, Khalil Parker. Lunch is at 11:45 to 12:45. Then the afternoon session starts at 1 o'clock to 2:15. The closing ceremonies is from 2:30 to 3:30, and then networking from 3:30 to 4. So there's two events coming up here in Philadelphia within this week, Richard, that was that's sponsored by two of the panelists. Two of the eight, sometimes nine panelists that we have. So their work is still continuing. We're going to do another follow-up to the political discussions that we've been having here. I guess about another month and a half, we'll get somebody else up to the plate again. I did speak with Brother Khalid Rahim today. They got back late last night. And they thanked everybody for coming out and being a part of the discussion. They're looking forward to continuing discussion and getting us any information about any updates. I think he said that they're supposed to go to Chicago next because they've been asked to come there. I told him about the brother in Alton, Missouri, that requested that he would contact him, the brother from last week, Richard.
Right.
This discussion around this will continue. You know, yesterday I cited to them that, you know, when we use that 50-year barometer here in Philadelphia, that's about the time when you started having black politicians kind of proliferate all these offices here in the city. But when you look at some of the main points that, you know, that I stress, and I'm no economist or I'm no expert, but to me, a litmus test to show the success of any leader is the economics or the business development in your communities, the education, the housing, and jobs. And if you use that as a litmus test for any of these black politicians in Philadelphia or any of the areas where our people dwell, the economic development in Philadelphia for black men and women is minuscule at best. The education, well, we see what's happening in a lot of these major cities. A lot of the schools are closing. They're being used for urban development, gentrification, the housing and jobs. Philadelphia is the has the largest poverty rate of any major city in this country with over a million people. Mm-hmm. I think it's around 28%.
Right.
And in black neighborhoods, it's off the charts. So that shows a failure of black leadership across the board. So we have to, I mean, we don't have an option. We have to do something about this.
And doing our part in, you know, one thing that you said as far as creating a venue where organizers can network and communicate on their activity, not just because it's an activity, because it's a part of the overall politics. I think that political education, because it's not just their activists, but everybody's operating from different points of view also. So how do we create a unified, even with the structure of a political party, how do we create a unified political leadership that is authentic to the people that we come from, you know, is the challenge after 50 years, because what we looked at is individuals who come out of the communities. But obviously, as you said, when you look at the litmus tests or the barometers that are being used to evaluate them from, they're not necessarily have been representing the condition of the people itself. I don't even want to say community, because when you talk about poverty and health and education, these are life issues, not necessarily geographical issues. Mm-hmm. And if they're life issues, they're people issues. And we should be using our political representation to kind of assist in our quality of life, changing our quality of life. And it shouldn't be reflecting what we were brought here to do, just be waste, beast of burden, and wealth creators for somebody else.
You know what? It's 7:30. What we'll do, we'll take a brief break. When we come back, we'll bring on our guests. Organizer and activist, Black Voters Matter co-founder, Brother Cliff Albright, who'll be joining us right after this brief break. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Time for Awakening. We'll be right back.
Listening to Time for an Awakening, Time for an Awakening, with host Brother Elliot and Brother Richard on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
All Insurance Incorporated, an African American owned and operated insurance agency in business for over 20 years, located at 231 Southeastern Road in Glenside, PA, with other offices in Germantown and West Philadelphia. Call now for commercial insurance quotes, homeowners insurance quotes, automobile insurance quotes, notary and tax services, representing over 15 major A-rated insurance companies, offering a discount on all notary services if when you call in for a free quote. Call this number, 215-885-2444. That number is 215-885-2444. 215-885-2444. All Insurance Incorporated.
I transformed a $24,000 a year odd job handyman service into a seven-figure high-end custom home builder and commercial contractor licensed and operating in three states. This is just one of the tangible transformations I've created for entrepreneurs in various industries around the country. If this isn't what you think of when you think of accounting and business consulting, then get ready to take down this invaluable information. Are you an entrepreneur suffering with a stagnating company? Have headache customers, staff, or vendors? Are you rebounding from a loss and need help achieving your unrealized potential? Or are you a startup who wants to get it right the first time and avoid the costly mistakes? Hi, my name is Nataki Kanban. If you're ready to go beyond advising and coaching and get results, then call 301-244-9072. Let New Business Solutions recommend and implement the best comprehensive sales, administrative, human resources, accounting, and operations to help you grow into your vision for yourself and your company. Again, from anywhere nationally, call 301-244-9072 or pull us up on your device right now and book your free consultation at www.newbusinesssolutions.com. and just mention you heard the special announcement on Time for an Awakening.
RG Electrical Inspections provides electrical inspections for realtors, licensed electricians, and homeowners. Licensed and insured underwriter, serving Philadelphia and surrounding area. Call today, 484-268-9837.
For 12 years, I and others like me had held out radiant promises of progress. I had preached to them about my dream. I had lectured to them about the not too distant day when they would have freedom all here now. Amen. I had urged them to have faith in America and in white society. Their hopes had soared. They were now booing me because they felt that we were unable to deliver on our promises. They were booing because we had urged them to have faith in people who had too often proved to be unfaithful. They were now hostile because they were watching the dream that they had so readily accepted turn into a frustrating nightmare. And so the collision course is set.
The desegregation decisions and other type of legislation and Supreme Court decisions depends upon changing the white man's mind. The Honorable Elijah Muhammad teaches us that our own mind has to be changed. We have to change our mind about ourselves.
In what way?
Well, so he teaches us the importance of moral reformation, a knowledge of self. And for instance, the average so-called Negro, he doesn't think that he can go into business and provide jobs for himself. And because of this, he thinks that he can only get a job from the white man, or he can only get clothes from the white man, or he can only get food from the white man. And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad are taught that the same thing that the white man has done for himself and his kind, if our people could be wrecked, if we could be cured of our slave mentality that was indoctrinated into us during slavery, we would realize that just as the white man can do these things for himself and his kind, we can get together in unity and harmony and do the same thing for ourselves and our kind.
Not wondering at all about them. I'm concerned with the suffering and the pain of the masses of black people. No one wants to pay reparations. The Jews received over $100 billion in reparations and gets $4 billion annually. A Holocaust museum was set up for them on this soil for over $200 million, and they get $21 million annually just for operating expenses. But the Catholic Church, the Pope, the Jews, the Arabs, white people in general, no one wants to pay reparations to these, the sons and daughters of Africa. So I speak to them. I don't speak to the family of those two Jews. There are too many of us for me to speak to them.
And one of the reasons why I'm always happy to come to this organization, because you're the only one, you're the only black organization, again, that understands to put race first. Race first. Race first. And I've had some white folks to tell me that I was a flaming militant, a radical, or whatever all of these names were that they called me. And I said that I am very pleased that you called me a nationalist, because you could have said that I was a member of the NAACP or the Urban League. So I said, I'm very pleased of the names that you have given. But I said that because we put race first, something is wrong with us. But everybody else puts their own first, because God bless the child who has his own. And so I think that race first is very important. And though we meet in a different venue, we're not at the slave theater, we're not at the church, we're now at the Masonic Temple, it really does not matter where we are physically. It matters where we are in our minds. And wherever we meet, as long as we know that we're Africans and as long as we know that we are black people living here in America, we know exactly who we are. You notice you can put an Uncle Tom in any venue in the White House. You can even put him in his. He's going to still be a Tom. You can put them anywhere you want. Well, it's the same thing with us who are strong people. Wherever we are, we're going to be the people that we need to be.
Let me just say this before our time winds up. And that is, I want the people in the audience to go back and look at the video clip from Roots. It's entitled something like Breaking Kunta Kinte. That scene opens with Lorne Green sitting in, who's the plantation master, sitting in his office, and then Fiddler comes in and says, we don't want to be too hard on the runaway. Kunta Kinte has just run away and been caught. And so the time comes for him to get his lashing. And if you look at this scene, it's about 9 minutes, and study the scene. Study the role of everybody or bodies that are in this particular clip. And you will find that there is an equivalent role in the political life of our country today, whether it's on the national level or on the local level. There's the black man who actually does the whipping of Kunta Kinte. There's the white man who does the whipping. There's the black man who intervenes with the boss man and tries to save the life of Kunta Kinte. There's Kunta himself, who eventually is forced to admit that his name is Toby. And there's dozens of bystanders, black, who are watching. This is a very powerful scene. And it's an analogy of exactly what is happening in our community today. Let's give those characters names in our community and call them what they are, and then take care of business about that.
Welcome back to Time for an Awakening, and it's Sunday evening here in the city of Philadelphia. It's 7:43. You can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Brother Richard.
Yes, sir.
At this time, we're going to bring on our guest, activist, organizer of Black Voters Matter, the co-founder, Brother Cliff Albright, is joining us this evening. You know, we heard that clip that played, and at the end, Cynthia McKinney talked about dozens of bystanders standing by who are black. But if we can do anything as a people, we must motivate our people, as categorized as Cynthia McKinney, that are standing on the sidelines. We have to do something to motivate them to get involved, to change our paradigm, whether socially or even politically. Organize is what Kwame Ture said. And we're going to talk to Brother Cliff Albright because he's been doing some organizing down in the Black Belt where he is. Brother Cliff, are you there?
Yes, I am. How are you?
How are you, sir?
How you doing now?
Great. Hey, great. It's glad to be with you, Brother Elliot and Richard. Thanks for having me.
Brother Cliff, I want you to kind of tell our voters about the activities of Black Voters Matter, you being the co-founder. But before you do that, talk about the origin and why you got involved in even starting this.
Yeah, well, you know, the origins in many ways are related to a couple of those clips that you played.
Okay.
You know, from both Malcolm and from Martin, you know, but I've been a social justice activist, you know, to start my entire adult life, and originally from New York, we moved down south in 98 to Alabama, to the Black Belt of Alabama, to Selma, the home of the voting rights movement, and that's really where I did, you know, the beginnings of my work in the electoral sphere, you know, right. Always done, and even while in Selma, continue to do social justice work on a range of issues, ranging from economic development to, you know, criminal justice and police brutality and youth development and a range of issues. But of course, you can't be in Selma and not be involved in voting rights.
Okay.
And so, you know, through our experiences, both at the local level, at the state level, even at the national level, getting involved in national campaigns, even in other states like, you know, in Alabama and Georgia and Texas and Cleveland, you know, just really started to put together both myself as well as Latasha Brown, who's my, you know, dear friend and co-founder of Black Voters Matters, just started thinking about, you know, what would we do if we had the resources to really invest in power building work. And, you know, I say power building because we're not just a elections or voting organization. We refer to ourselves as a power building organization. We are about investing in and building capacity to build power in Black communities. And so the origins really go back, you know, at least those 20 years of our work in that area, but also beyond that to our studies, because we both consider ourselves students of the civil rights movement. And so through our studies of you know, efforts like the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party and the Lowndes County Freedom Organization and other efforts of, you know, ways that we went about trying to build independent political power. So, so we, you know, decided in 2016 to start the organization, started in a small scale with just one race right here in Georgia. And then in 2017, got involved in the Alabama Senate race, which was the contest between Roy Moore and Doug Jones. And, you know, our involvement in that really just, it came, you know, kind of last minute in the last few weeks. Is folks that we knew in Alabama on the ground were telling us that there wasn't enough resources to get into our communities. And so, you know, it seemed hard to believe because we were watching news stories on the network news every day talking about how much money was flowing into that race, especially after the stories about the pedophilia issues came. And then, but it still seemed strange, but not strange, that money wasn't making it to our folks, right? And so we went about trying to raise money in those last few weeks, and we were able to raise close to $200,000 that we were then able to put into the hands of grassroots groups throughout the state, you know, in 18 counties, so that they could get involved in mobilizing their communities. And that's really what's at the heart of our core beliefs with Black Voters Matter. But that's the way we kind of got started.
You know, I didn't realize when that news story hit about seniors being put off a bus that was trying to organize other people and other seniors to vote, that was your group. That was your bus that you had people on. Am I right in that?
Yeah. So fast forward from 2017 to 2018. So December 2017 was the Alabama race. And then all throughout 2018, starting as early as January, February, we were involved in supporting groups and mobilizing Black voters in seven states. Predominantly in the South, and those seven states were Alabama, Georgia, Mississippi, North Carolina, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Florida. And the incident that you're talking about came about through our work in Georgia. And as a part of that work, we were going around the South. And when I named those states, y'all know what those states are, right? We talk about the old Confederacy, basically. Mm-hmm. So we were driving around in what we referred to as the blackest bus in America. And we say the blackest bus for several reasons. One, because visually it was black, you know, it was all black.
Okay.
But even in terms of the images that were on the bus, and so we had images of, you know, black folks with their fists in the air and the words power on the bus and the images of the states that we were driving through and images of some of the work that we were doing. So the visual, both the blackness in terms of the color, but also in terms of the message that was on it, and in terms of the work that was being done out of that bus, because we always used to say, if that bus shows up, the bus itself wasn't the work, but if it shows up, it's because somewhere in that community there was some work going on, and likely some work that we were supporting with some of our financial support or other support. And so with that bus, the incident you're talking about was in Georgia, in Jefferson County, Georgia, which again is one of those counties. We do work in cities. Like in Georgia, we'll do a little bit in Atlanta or in some of the mid-sized cities like Savannah and Columbus. In Alabama, we'll do work in Montgomery and Birmingham. But one of our special features, one of our niches, is that we do work and go to and support work and visit counties that are often overlooked. And Jefferson County, Georgia, was one of those counties where we visited and had a great session with some seniors at a senior center of doing a rally and getting folks all energized and then bringing them out to the bus and you know, basically having a dance party, you know, because everywhere we go, we consider ourselves cultural organizers. And so we bring our music. And so we play, you know, James Brown, I'm Black and I'm Proud. You know, we play Kendrick Lamar, We Gonna Be All Right. We play Public Enemy, you know, talk about Fight the Power. And so we were having that kind of a celebration, and then the folks say, well, we want to go vote, because this was during the early vote period here in Georgia. So we get on the bus and we're getting ready to go vote, and the center gets a call from the county commissioner's office saying, you know, those seniors can't go vote on that bus. They need to get off the bus. And so that incident was caught on video, and video went kind of viral, and then we wound up talking about it on some network news stations. But the aftermath of that was instructive for a couple of reasons. One, because what we saw was, at the end of the day, even though we did not go take those seniors vote that day on that bus, all of those seniors went to go, but more importantly, they were inspired to go out and get even more people to go vote. So the one vote per person that would have showed up if we had just taken them down turned out to be 5 votes or 10 votes for each of them, because they all left there even more fired up to go do the work and do the organizing and bring even more people out to vote. But the other piece of it was listening to the rationale that the county commission office gave for why they even made that call, which was just outright illegal, right? Which they had no authority to make. They had no control over how and with whom those seniors went. This wasn't like one of those centers where it's like a health, you know, a senior health center where they're like in the care of a facility. This was like a day center, like where folks, they get there on their own, they leave on their own, and how they get there and how they leave is their business.
Mm-hmm.
So the county had absolutely no say in who they went to go vote with. And so, but listening to the rationale, you know, and they said this to us when we eventually got a face-to-face meeting with them, we were uncomfortable with them going to vote with you all. We didn't know who you were. We had not had a chance to vet you, right? This was the type of patriarchal, of racist, of patronizing language that they were using. We needed permission from them to go and speak with our folks, you know, or to take our folks to go vote. And that's the kind of issue, and we said this all the time, that's the kind of issue that we deal with in these rural communities on a daily basis. The issues that you see that you saw happen in North Carolina with that congressional district where they were stealing absentee votes, you could go to any one of these rural counties in the South, and I dare say in the North and the Midwest as well, and you've got this type of funny business and voter suppression going on, but it stays under the radar because a lot of times it happens in isolated communities.
Brother Cliff, and I'm going to ask this one more thing, Richard, and I'm going to pass the mic over to you. Brother Cliff, the challenge that we have, And especially you men and women that are boots on the ground, is organizing our people. We had Charles Cobb on the program a while ago, and he wrote the book, This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed. He was the first one, him and Stokely Carmichael, who was his good friend at Howard, was the first two down there that left Howard to start organizing down in Mississippi. Now, he told us initially they weren't going to Mississippi. They were going to Texas, but they stopped in Mississippi and were encouraged to stay there. So they did. And you know what happened behind that, because you spoke about Lowndes County and things like that. They were all down there. They spearheaded that movement. But he talked about the challenges of them trying to organize our people. Do you find, being that you said that you were a student of the civil rights era, and you are down there in the Black Belt, do you find the similarities between how they had to organize our people and the challenges they face to even now, 50, 60 years later?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, because many of the issues are still the same issues, right? You still got some of the same systems of control. You know, you still got a fear around talking about Black power. You know, in a lot of communities that we go to, power is like a dirty word. You know, the notion that, now it's a little bit different in Alabama and Mississippi, right? But the notion that in communities, in counties, in parishes, in the case of Louisiana, where we are the majority, that there's an expectation that we control a majority of positions, like that expectation doesn't exist everywhere, right? The expectation that with our numbers should come political power and representation, that's not a universal thought, right? And so in some places, for you to talk about that, it's kind of like taboo, because we respond to power. And I don't think it's something that's just limited to the South. I think we see it in the North as well.
Most definitely.
But we respond to power as if it's a dirty word because of the way that power has been used against us so unrighteously. We start to think that, you know, even just having power is something that's dirty, is something that's bad, right? That it goes against these concepts of love, which is why one of our favorite quotes, and it's the quote that guides a lot of our work and it guides our South is Rising tour that we did with the bus, is the quote from Dr. King where he's talking about love and power. He says, power without love is reckless and abusive, but love without power is sentimental and anemic. And so one of the things we are constantly trying to do as we travel around, as we talk to communities, is to get folks just comfortable with that notion of power. But yeah, some of the challenges that they face then still remain to this day. You know, and I think fundamentally it's because a lot of the relationships and the power dynamics haven't changed. You were talking earlier about the economic issues. That's something that we're constantly going up against. For us, building political power, like, that's almost the easy part. We know we can do that part. But it's the issues about, well, what's the economic consequences of that? Because we've seen the backlash that comes when we start talking about power and when we achieve power. We've seen businesses pull out of counties, right? We've seen, you know, people lose their jobs and their economic sustainability. And so that's why with our work, part of what we always try to do is recognize that those two things have got to be connected, the political discussions, but also the discussions around building economic power. Those two things have got to go hand in hand. But the challenges are still the same. But the good news is this, and it's the last thing I want to say on that. The good news is this, in the South, and this is a little bit different with the North, in the South, there's an understanding of land. Even when you look back at the voting rights movement in Alabama, voting rights movement in Mississippi, those movements could not have happened in those rural counties without some of the independent Black farm owners who actually own their land and who helped support the movement. And so even as you looked at the march from Selma to Montgomery, some of the places where they were able to stop and camp out, right, that movement could not have happened without folks that had some level of economic independence. And that really comes from, I think, the fact that in the South there's a deeper appreciation of our connection to the land, even given all of the land loss that's taking place, right? But there's a fundamental understanding of the independence that comes with that. And that's an asset, right? That as we do our work, we try to tap into. So there's some challenges of being in the rural South, but there's also some basic understandings and some issues that kind of, in some senses, make that kind of long-term economic self-sufficiency argument a little bit easier to get across to folks.
You know, brother, I appreciate the work that you're doing. And there's a couple of things I take from what you're saying and your experience that I just want you to maybe unpack for me. And it may be personal. Because in that example that you gave in relationship to the amount of money that was going to the dish for the vote to get the voting turnout, is it fair to say that the money was being held back? And I'm thinking you're talking about because of the Democratic Party, because most of the voting in the South, most of the Black votes in particular, is up members of the Democratic Party. So there's been reports that the Democratic Party really hasn't been supporting grassroots organizing in relationship to voters' turnout. Is that a true assessment from your vantage point?
Yeah, I think that's definitely a true statement. And that's exactly what the problem was with the Alabama race at the time. I think that there's been some lessons learned. So now you've got all this talk, right, of people kind of recognizing the power of Black women voters and of putting more money into some local organizing. There's a little bit more talk around that, but there's still not the real understanding of how to do that, right? There's still, and we've seen this in other elections since that 2017 election, where people are trying to figure out how to get more local workers, but it's still not an investment in local organizations, right? You can come with some money from outside and start hiring up some local folks, and that's certainly better than when you just parachute in a whole bunch of folks from New York or DC or from California, right? But it's not the same as actually investing in the indigenous organizations and the local organizations and let them controlling those resources to hire folks, to print their own materials, to do their own messaging and all of that. That's the kind of approach that we try to take. We invest in those local groups and let them have more control over how it is that they use it. And we assist by bringing in some tools. So bringing in some phone banking or some texting for text banking or some other tools that they can use or some data lists and things of that nature. But fundamentally, it's about letting them do what they do best, which is be authentic messengers and delivering an authentic message. And that's the overall approach.
And I agree. And hopefully in the few questions I get to, ask on this, because I really have to unpack, and you gave a good example of in these counties, and we ain't talking about just, as you said, the South, but even in the North, and specifically what we see in Philadelphia, there is a plantation kind of mindset and operation, not just a mindset, but an operation that's going on in relationship to the voter participation. So, now let me move to this point that you raised, because there is authentic organizations on the ground that the Democratic Party, and I don't know if that's uncomfortable to say, but that the Democratic Party doesn't see as a viable mechanism to support. So my question to you, as you move around, you do see this authentic organization, and that's one side of it. And the other side, isn't that different than a movement or mobilization? What I'm saying is that these people are actually been there doing this, know how to communicate, know what needs to be said, know how to get people out, and they're doing it on bare bone resources compared to trying to excite people to get involved. And the party should know that. And am I correct to say that the party is acting like it don't?
Yeah, I think that's still correct. I think that's still definitely correct. Again, I think there's a little bit more of a recognition that there needs to be something that they need to do it a different way, but that still hasn't happened on large scale. And so those organizations that you're talking about are still massively underfunded. And not just underfunded at the election time, right? Because the other part of what we have a core belief on is that this work has got to take place throughout the year. Right. And so even as there's starting to be more recognition that, oh, maybe we do need to invest in some of these existing organizations, it's still looked at from that that bean counting approach that, you know, we talk about, where what they're really saying is they care about black votes, but they don't care about black voters. See, when you care about black votes, then you show up 2 weeks before the campaign, and you ask those organizations that you're talking about to go round up Negroes, right? to go round up because election day is coming. But when you care about black voters, you see that this work has got to take place all throughout the year, and that those organizations are in our communities doing this work all throughout the years. Even when they're not doing the electoral work, what are they doing? They're dealing with gentrification issues. They're dealing with healthcare issues. Mm-hmm. They're dealing with our education issues. That work needs to be sustained throughout the year, because then when it comes election time, you're not having to just round up the Negroes. You've already been base building and building power all throughout the year. But that's the difference between investing in this work because we care about rounding up the votes versus investing in this work because we care about the voters and we care about the long-term sustainability of our organizations and needs and in our communities. Those are two different approaches. And so you're right. There's definitely shortcomings in how the party does it and when they do it and then who they go to partner with to get this stuff done. There's shortcomings in all three of those areas. That's why we do what we do, really independent of the party structures, you know, because in a lot of the states where we do this work, the party structures aren't even, they're almost non-existent, you know, like the Democratic Party in Alabama, the Democratic Party in South Carolina, you know, the Democratic Party, like and not just the statewide, but in some of these counties, like there is no structure. Heck, in some of these counties, it's Republicans that are controlling the county Democratic Party.
that's what I want to get to. You know, this is a part of just dialogue, right? And I'm glad that you're independent enough and actually, as Elliot said, you have your boots on the ground and actually see, because what you had spoke to in relationship to power building, but also in relationship to just what you raised, that in some counties there's Republicans, because in some counties there are black people that outnumber demographically whites in those areas, right? So the question that I'm wrestling with, does that mean that the Democratic Party, its loyal base of voters, however they get them, they come in last minute or not, and primarily they come in last minute, they do not want to be challenging the power arrangement when we're talking about power building. I'm asking, you know, if you feel comfortable that may be a fair assessment. You know, taking it outside of just trying to get the election and win the election, but looking at it from power building and the power contest. Because what you said about the experience you had about those seniors on the bus, and they said, we got to vet you. That's a power relationship. Right. That they are expressing, and they're saying they have the power, and the Democratic Party is saying we're not funding natural organizations on the ground because that would be in their power building capacity.
Right.
That's speculative, but would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, I think you've got fundamentally, it's a rare situation where you've got you know, party officials at the county level that have a real interest in building up a political base or a political framework or other organizations that are outside of their party structure. It's the rare situation from what we've seen in the states where we've been working. Every now and then you find a county where there's some folks, some community-centered folks who are in charge of a county, a local party structure, and they really understand the power building piece, right? And they want to build power by whatever means necessary. And part of it they do through the party structure, and then part of it they want to support other groups that are doing whatever they do. You see that every now and then, but for the most part, you know, there's some level of resistance to really wanting to build up local power outside of that party structure and outside the very narrow purpose of winning a couple of more seats for the party, right? And so there's a natural tension there. And as long as we're aware of it, you know, we can work that out, right?
But you have to be, as you are, you have to be independent, though. I mean, because we're recognizing that you're doing it as an independent, and you know that you have to find resources other places in order to support those kind of groups, because it's not the same as saying that those people who have, I mean, not just, they got analysts, they got resource, they got people, if they can fly people in, they, you know, they have all this here social capital and in human capital they can provide to assist local county individuals in developing their political organization, but they're not. And then, you know, so that it's different when you're independent. You can see this and you're still at a disadvantage because you have to do everything, if I'm not mistaken.
No, you're absolutely right. And the challenge, again, is that in these states, many of these states where we've been doing this work are states that have been written off, you know, with the exception of Georgia, which, you know, people kind of looked at as, even Georgia, right? Even though people have been looking at it as being possibly purple and that it has some potential and all that stuff, it's still been drastically underinvested in recent years. And so, whereas you look, you know, if you look back at 2016 or 2012, when you look at the amount of investment that's gone in some of these other states where they've been chasing these mythical, you know, white moderate voters.
Right. You know? I mean, that's what they've been saying. What they've been saying. And that's why it makes it so difficult. And that's why we're kind of, you know, looking at this independent political part, you know, from a black independent, because it seems that, you know, as you said, and you gave a great characterization, it's just like, we just want your vote. Pick the cotton. You know, we call it balloting. 1 million conscious and conscientious black voters and contributors call it balloting. It's not voting. All you do is go and click the ballot, you know,
right.
Do that and go home.
Right. That's right. You know, and so there's been little incentive because they've considered these states as being, you know, unwinnable. You know, there's just hasn't been any incentive for them to really invest in the states, to build up the local party structures, to invest in the organizations that are on the ground. And then something weird happens, right? The Alabama Senate race becomes in play. A Mississippi Senate race becomes in play. And then they want to scramble around and figure out how they can round up folks. But, you know, the fact that you've underinvested in these communities for so long makes those special opportunities not be able to produce what they ought to be able to produce. So our position is you've got to invest in this work in each of these states, in all of these counties, wherever we have a presence. You've got to do that all throughout the year. And if there's no such thing as an off year, right? We always say that in, you can't come, you know, every 4 years or every 2 years, whichever the case may be, but mainly every 4 years, and then show up in October and you asking black folks to save the country in November. You know, right. But meanwhile, you were lost, but you've been out of sight for 2 or 3 years. And then even in that election year, all you care about is the November election. But for us in our counties, a lot of the real battles take place in the primary because of the reason that you said that we've got conservative whites or even conservative blacks sometimes that will run in a Democratic primary in the county, because in a lot of these counties, that's the only race that matters, right? Mm-hmm. And so for our communities, when we're talking about who's sheriff, it's not always about which Democrats which is running against which Republican in November. A lot of times the battle is against some really conservative sheriff candidate who's running as a Democrat, and maybe a moderate or progressive sheriff candidate who's running also as a Democrat in that same primary. Sometimes the differences between the candidates in the primary are more stark than the differences between the candidates in the November election. But all the outside folk, all the national folk care about is what happens in November. So you ignore my community in May or April or whenever that primary is. You ignore us and you don't invest in us when we needed you to show up. But then you show up with 2 weeks left in October asking us to help win this Senate seat or this governor's seat. That's not sustainable, you know, and it's hypocritical. And, you know, I think our communities are coming to a recognition and demanding that folks see us and hear that we matter all throughout the year and in every year, even if other folks are looking at it as an off year.
We're in conversation with activist, organizer of Black Voters Matter, co-founder Brother Cliff Albright is with us this evening. And you can get involved in the conversation by dialing 215-490-9832. That's 215-490-9832. Let's go to North Carolina and BTR. Are you there, brother? BTR.
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to the host and to the guests this evening. I want to ask the guest a question. You know, he's an activist. Y'all were talking earlier about boycotts and economic power. You mentioned Mississippi. And if you're not aware of what I'm about to bring up, you know, I don't place no blame on anybody because it's being suppressed by the major networks. I just did a Google search on the Combating BDS Act, and, you know, the major networks that most people get their news from are not doing, they're purposely, in my opinion, not doing stories on this. So my question for the guests first is, are you aware of the case NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware, which was came out of an economic boycott by the NAACP and local organizations in Mississippi in 1966?
I think so. I know that there was a time, I thought it was, I might be thinking about the Alabama case, because I know there was a time when the whole issue of boycotts was banned, and it's actually part of the reason why in Alabama that, you know, some of the work was done through the offices of the MIA, the Improvement Association, versus the NAACP. I'm not as familiar with that case in Mississippi, but I think it's along the same lines. I might know a little bit about it.
Okay, just to give you some brief information about it. So there was some police brutality going on, and so the NAACP and local organizations called for an economic boycott on white businesses in that area. Those white businesses then sued the NAACP and those other organizations, and it went to the Mississippi Supreme Court and held that those organizations were liable for any losses that in revenue that, you know, the targeted businesses had. So right. it was then appealed, and it went to the U.S. Supreme Court, which ruled 8-0 that economic boycotts, and I'm going to just read this. This was their decision. They ruled in favor of the NAACP and those organizations. They said that boycotts and related activities to bring about political, social, and economic change our political speech occupying the highest rung of the hierarchy of First Amendment values. And I don't have to tell you, brother, you know how, you know, our community has used, you know, economic boycotts in the past and most successfully to bring down apartheid in South Africa. So I'm sure you're aware of that, right?
Right, right.
So with this combating BDS Act does, and it just got advanced through the committee, the U.S. Senate committee. It was a bill introduced by Marco Rubio out of Florida, but it has bipartisan support. There were only like 17, and they were all Democrats, I believe. I had to check the record again, but the most notable Democrats who voted against it on First Amendment speech grounds were Bernie Sanders, Dianne Feinstein, she's running for what's her name, Kirsten Gillibrand, and disappointed. Well, I ain't gonna say I was disappointed, because, you know, I look at them as establishment types anyway, but Kamala Harris was too busy doing a CNN town hall to even show up for the vote, and Cory Booker abstained from voting. So you know what they're trying to do is you know, it's specifically talking about anybody. It's specifically trying to give cover to the 26 states that have anti-BDS legislation that's targeting Israel the same way that South Africa was targeted. And if you, let's say, have a business and you're on contract with the states, or you do business with the state, then you can lose those contracts.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, here's my problem. you know, first of all, I'm a human rights defender. First of all, I stand for justice no matter who it's for or who it's against, like Malcolm X said. But for those that don't really care about what's happening to Palestinians and what have you in that area of the world, this to me could set a new precedence to where they would just outlaw all economic boycotts, you know. And for example, like say you got a nonprofit organization, and see what's really making me mad is the NAACP. This is part of their legacy. This is something they fought through the courts for darn near 20 years, you know, and they won, and now they're not even defending it. Nobody's talking about it. I mean, absolutely nobody. It's not like it's not an issue at all. So, I mean, what if a justice organization that stands up for the human rights of people, you know, what if they can, to me, they could lose their nonprofit status if they endorse like a economic boycott and endorse the BDS movement, as you just saw, and they finally gave it back to her. But was that in Alabama where they took Angela Davis had gotten that award by that Civil Rights Museum or whatever, and they took it from her. And that was behind pressure from these pro-Israeli firsters, is what I call them. And I'm just at a loss for words, brother, and I'm just wondering why this ain't on people's radar, because I mean, economic boycotts have been historically a very important and effective tool in fighting injustice. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, so a couple of directions going at. I mean, one, you're absolutely right. It hasn't received a lot of attention, in the media or from, you know, some of our groups, except for those groups that are most active in, you know, in their solidarity with the Palestinian movement. You know, some of those groups have been vocal about it, but, you know, they've been vocal about it and they don't have a lot of access to the airways, right? But I think definitely for the media as a whole, and then for our, you know, most folks in our community, it's either too distant of an issue, or more often than not, it's just an issue that they just don't know about. You know, because of all the reasons that you said, it's just not getting coverage. You know, all you get coverage of is Trump all day, and mm-hmm. But truth be told, there's a whole lot of other issues that are even closer to home that aren't getting a lot of coverage. Whether it's you know black girls going missing, or you know, or the police shooting of the week, or I mean, right now in Brooklyn, you got prisoners who are without heat. You know, in these freezing temperatures in a Brooklyn jail that's getting, you know, no coverage, right? And so you've got all of these issues that aren't getting covered, and some of those issues are issues that are like directly at home. And so, you know, then you got those issues that are struggling to get attention, and then you got this kind of global, you know, this global solidarity issue that's not and it's not just the issue of global solidarity, because as you're saying, it impacts organizations right here in this country that might be, you know, speaking out about that. But it's hard for it to cut through all the rest of the stuff that's going on, and all the other issues that also aren't getting attention on the media. So, but you're right, you know, you talked about Angela Davis. It was Birmingham. It was her hometown, right? The Civil Rights Institute in her hometown that made that dreadful mistake, which they now admit is a mistake, and they're trying to go back and reoffer her the award. But it's the third, you know, Mark Lamont Hill, the CNN commentator, who was removed from CNN and then had people coming after him because of remarks that he made that were critical of the treatment of the Palestinians. And so it's one of those issues. It's like the third rail type issue of the black progressive movement, where, you know, if you get caught on the wrong side of it, you know, you out of job, you face a potential legal, you know, but it's one of those issues that we've got to have a very open discussion around. But again,
last question, but do you see it possibly as I see it, that You know, they not going to stop with just, oh, you can't boycott Israel. I could see this, you know, turning into something to where, you know, it'll set a precedence and then all economic boycott. Hey, you want to boycott the local Asian hair salon because they mistreating black? Well, no, these are against the law. I can just see it expanding to that. And I'll listen to your response offline. Thank you.
Thank you for your call, sir.
No, I agree. It definitely, you know, it definitely could expand, you know, to the point where, you know, it could very easily be. You can't criticize the president or else you, you know, you face whatever. I mean, it could easily expand to other issues or topics becoming taboo and being punishable. So you're, it's the criminalization of free speech. And it's not without, you know, people say all the time, every time we talk about, oh, the country moving towards fascism or, you know, or some other thing, you know, people say, oh, you exaggerate it and that can never happen. When you look at the things, even just within the past 2 years that have been tolerated and have become now the norm, right? There's no reason why, you know, any of these policies couldn't be expanded and just and become the norm. And the norm can be that you can't have, you know, criticism of any of these things that they're trying to protect. And then just think about the contradiction of this comes at the same time that in terms of political money, they're going in the opposite direction, right? They say corporations can spend whatever they want because that's free speech. So corporations can spend whatever they want on elections, right? But you can't speak about, you know, about Israel or Zionism or boycotting or anything like that without facing repercussions. That's a slippery slope.
If I can, Elliot and Brother, you know, what Brother Scotty brought up raised this question when we're talking about, thinking of the financing of these organic organizations on the ground. We know that we see that the right out of the gate, the two front runners for presidential candidates are two black people, and we know the last presidential candidate and president was a black person. But if I understand you correctly, still the party didn't fund these organic organizations. Do you see, based off of your, you know, any what you hear in the wind as an independent, that they as candidates are talking to the party in relationship to being more forthright with supporting and resources, the electoral process by them running and catering to the black vote. Do you see any, or hear anything that that seems to show that they would be advocating more resources within these natural democratic enclaves?
That the candidates themselves will be advocating for that?
Yes, because they are part of the Democratic Party and they're looking for the party. In the end, they want the party to support them as a candidate, right?
Right.
So, and they would want to win in those areas, so they would want, I mean, I'm in trying to develop it for clarity. I'm just, you know, I'm trying to understand what is happening. What's the disconnect between black presidential Democratic members who are aware that these organic organizations are not getting the resources from the Democratic Party and what they are doing to assist that now in them running? Because they didn't do that when Obama ran.
Right.
And I'm asking, did you hear anything of possibility that will change?
No, I haven't heard anything yet. I think it's in terms of what their positions are on it. I think it's kind of early. Of course, every candidate from their perspective prefers that whatever resources are put into the effort go directly to their to their campaign. And then so the real question is whether or not those candidates have a perspective where, as they're getting money in it, they're directing it to certain organizations. So So, yeah, I mean, I think that just remains, it just remains to be seen. I think there are probably people in California who could speak to whatever Kamala Harris's practice has been along those lines. And there's probably people in New Jersey who can speak a little bit towards what Corey's practice has been along those lines. But we'll see, you know, if they'll, you know, if they'll take that approach during the next year or so.
Brother Cliff, in your organizing and on the ground and you going into different communities in the Black Belt and talking with some of the grassroots organizers about their challenges to get our people involved, both young and old, and maybe particularly the young, what are they saying and how? Because I've seen some of the numbers from some of these races down south in Mississippi, in Georgia, in Alabama. I've seen some of the numbers of Black folks coming out and voting for candidates. What were some of the challenges that they said that they were dealing with, and how did you kind of get beyond that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the challenges are, you know, as we talked about, one, just not having enough resources to do the type of outreach that they want to do on the OLS because they need more financial resources to help put more boots on the ground. You know, you've got a lot of organizations that have traditionally had to rely on volunteer canvassers, right, or volunteer phone bankers, and you know, you'll get the most committed, but in order to really expand it the way that it needs to be expanded, you got to be able to tap into some folks who don't have the luxury to be able to volunteer, right? And so a lot of the groups just haven't had the financial resources that they need in order to expand their work. Now, and expanding that work means not just being able to, you know, pay canvassers or pay workers, but it also means, you know, do folks have the gas money to get around to some of these communities? Again, especially in these rural communities, you know, going door to door isn't like it is, you know, in the urban environment where going door to door might be taking five steps over to the next apartment door, right? It's often going down a dirt road. So, you know, transportation is an issue. Technology and Wi-Fi connectivity is an issue. You know, in some cases, just having the experience at doing some of the work and some of the outreach work is an issue. We've talked before about some of the pressure issues of fear or you know, facing the repercussions. We were in communities where folks felt like they couldn't put a sign in their yard because if the wrong person came by and saw that they had a certain sign in their yard, that they might face repercussions that way. And so you've got a variety of issues. You know, some dealing with funding, some dealing with infrastructure, and some just dealing with the overall environment or attitude towards civic engagement that folks have had to kind of navigate. And just the feelings of isolation.
Well, you know, and that's some of the main things that I wanted you to focus on, the challenges that you face behind people saying that they don't want to be involved civically, and also the fear, that fear factor that you talked about. Because in the North here, we might not get too much of the fear factor, but I see that it's still kind of prominent in certain areas of the South when you talk about the fear. If you follow what I'm trying to say, but right. We do get a lot because listen, we had a session up here yesterday. Myself and Brother Richard, Time for Awakening, hosted a panel discussion. It's the second one we've had on the need for some type of African-centered agenda, especially dealing in these communities in the city being rapidly gentrified. So we get a lot of, and especially young people that are not interested in voting. So right. that's a challenge, especially if you're trying to organize our people around the need to be able to learn to govern these communities in which they live in, because, you know, according to that term, politics is local. So I was wondering whether the same challenges, beside the money challenges, the same challenges exist down there where people are either disinterested, and then you talked about the fear.
Yeah, no, definitely the disinterest, and sometimes we try to avoid using the disinteresting because we think that it's kind of a misperception. You know, like people often talk about voter apathy. And one of the things that we argue all the time is that voters are not apathetic, right? Because apathy suggests a lack of passion or a lack of interest. And sometimes the lack of engagement is not a lack of passion or lack of interest. It's actually very much the opposite. It's because folks are so passionate about wanting better for the communities, but that they keep running up against the wall that they disengage from it. But it doesn't mean that there's a lack of passion around it. It's kind of similar to, you know, the child who's struggling in school. They're having a hard time reading, right? And when after having a hard time and not getting the help that they want, and the teacher's not able to really understand, and it's just not happening for them, right? What happens eventually? That child gets so frustrated that they disengage. Right. Mm-hmm. And maybe they even start talking about, I don't want to care. I didn't want to do that anyway. I didn't want to read anyway. I didn't want to get good grades anyway. Sometimes we see that and we think that that child, oh, they just don't care. No, it's because they care so much, but they have been so frustrated and so unable to get to where they were trying to get to, that then they just, as a defense mechanism, I mean, that's human, right? That you then, it then takes on the appearance of you just don't care or whatever. But it's really because you want to be engaged. And it's the same thing with our voting. When you have people who they want to see better in the community, but they're not able to vote. Their cousin can't vote because they're disenfranchised. This person can't vote because they're not given the time off work. Why it's not a national holiday, I don't know, right? And so, or they want to be engaged, but nobody ever came to knock on their door. Nobody sent them a text, and nobody gave them a phone call, right? They want to be engaged, but they don't know anything about these candidates who just popped up out of nowhere, right? Okay. Or they don't even know what this position is about. Like, what does the public service commissioner do? Right. So you've got this lack of engagement that isn't because folks are apathetic, but because they say we've been doing this. And I feel them. I feel it myself sometimes. And I do this work. We've been doing this for so long. And yet the poverty rate is the same as it was basically 45 years ago.
Okay.
Right. We've been doing this for so long. And ever since we got the Voting Rights Act, we've seen situations where we've had more black elected officials than we've ever had. But we're still poor. Right. Or I'm still fighting against this racism, or I'm still now having to fight up against a black elected official who seems to not. And so it's not just a disinterest and a lack of passion. And we always say when we come up against those, we run into those voters, that they're not crazy, because that's oftentimes what folks are made to feel, that they're crazy for then disengaging. And so we always start from the position and we say, you know what, that's not crazy. And so in fact, arguably, that position makes more sense than the position that says, let's just keep doing the same thing, right? Okay. And so when we engage them like that, and we're able to have a different kind of a conversation, and we've seen voters or non-voters that were disengaged all of a sudden see that they're not crazy, and that there's a role that they can play. And sometimes the space that we get to with folks is that we say, you know, you don't even have to accept that voting is a thing for building power, right? You tell us then what your answer is. Tell us what that issue that is so important to you, and we'll find another way that we could build power. Because if you tell me that you don't want to go vote next week, or that you can't go vote next week, cool. But tell me what you're going to do. Tell me which meeting you're going to show up for, or tell me who it is you're going to call to organize around that education issue that you're concerned about, or that criminal justice. So we engage in trying to get folks to see that it's okay to build power some other way. And sometimes just by being willing to have that conversation, that non-voter becomes a voter. Or sometimes they stay a non-voter, but they now have reached a higher level of potential activism. That's what we believe that this process is about. Yeah, we want folks to vote. We want turnout to go up. We want to win some of these offices, but if we can get somebody to shift in their mind that they have power to change the conditions in their community, sometimes that's just as important to win as the person who's going to vote religiously but doesn't fundamentally believe that they have the power to change our situation. We just, because when you're in that position, all you're doing is just going through the motion. But if we can get somebody to the point of really believing in their power, now a whole realm of possibilities are opened up for future change. So yes, that issue of folks being disinterested or unengaged, that's always an issue everywhere you go in Black communities in this country, and particularly amongst young folks. But one of the things that we've done with young folks, and one of the things that we found that people, younger voters, respond to,
okay,
are the criminal justice issues.
All right. So you've, okay, good. Now, one other thing, and I'll pass it over to Richard. Kamal Franklin, when he was on our program, talked about his experience and his time with the Jackson Cooperative that led to Chokwe Lumumba and eventually to Chokwe Antar Lumumba. You being down south and in the Black Belt, I'm quite sure you're running across not only the Jackson Cooperative, but the Universal African People's Organization out of the Missouri area. I think the Black Coffee Party is down there in Louisiana. Independent Black parties that are forming and trying to develop candidates, Black is Back Coalition, forming and trying to develop candidates. What is your experience there? Have you been running across them, some of the grassroots organizations that are pushing this? Talk about it.
Yeah, so, you know, it's weird. We haven't run across it a whole lot, although it's very much a part of my background. I'm actually one of those folks that started an independent party along with some other organizers. I just did a Facebook post about this just last week around, you know, our efforts to create an independent party in Selma, in Dallas County, Alabama, using the same laws that were on the books at the time as the Lowndes County Freedom Organization.
No, stop there a second. How long ago was this? Yep.
Lowndes County or my...
No. What you tried to do.
That was 2006.
Now, what were some of your challenges as far as starting in Selma, where a lot of historic things happened?
So two challenges in particular. First, you have the challenge of, I won't rank it in any order, but you have the challenge, which, as I've spoken to already, you've got the financial challenge, right?
Because
as you say, independent politics requires independent money, right? And so you've got that challenge. Secondly, and that's an issue that I think all of our independent efforts have really, you know, got to really learn some lessons on in terms of like how to really make the most out of like small donations and grassroots fundraising and all of that. But that's an issue. Secondly, you've got the issue of having to fight against, you know, this notion that, you know, that the only ways that we can do this is through one of the two parties.
Okay.
You know, and so you've got to fight through that just to get people to believe in some other kind of an option, right? Even to get to the point of where we were able to get on the ballot, which we were on the ballot not as like an independent whatever, but as an actual party with our own logo and everything. Even to get to that point in the petition process requires you speaking to enough people who can accept that this is something that we need, that we need to have a third option, that they're willing to sign on, at least to get on the ballot, even if they're not committing to voting for the candidate, that they at least believe that we need and deserve to have a third option, right? And so that's another level of work that you've got to do. But then there comes this third level that was really, really difficult. Even after you get people to conceptually believe in independent party and to support independent candidates, what also you got to get them to do is just the mechanics of actually voting for a third party, for an independent candidate, because in so many of these states you've got this ballot voting where all you do is mark one box and then your whole ballot gets filled in for one party, right? And so getting past that, the mechanics of that, right?
Okay.
Like, ooh, I actually have to go box the box, or I can do that single party vote, and then I can still do an independent for one specific race, right? Just the mechanics of how people actually do that is a challenge. And then the fourth layer is, you know, that you've got to overcome the fact that some friends will become adversaries. Right. Because some people who've been doing some good work in our community, right, but that they're too close to that Democratic Party structure.
Okay.
And so folks that you may have been doing a lot of organizing with on other campaigns or on other social justice issues, we may have both been at this criminal justice anti-police brutality rally and we united on that, But as soon as I start talking about this independent party, now we got to go separate ways. Mm-hmm. And so that issue is one that you've also got to be willing and able to navigate. So there's several layers to it. But what we've seen is it's doable and it's possible.
Okay.
And when third party efforts have fallen apart, it's not been because they couldn't work. It's actually been because of the exact opposite. It's because they were so successful that they wind up being co-opted by the mainstream, by the mainstream mm-hmm. parties. And that's what leads it. But it's not because the notion of independence itself doesn't work.
Okay, let's go to Newport News. Newport News.
Good evening, comrades. How you doing?
How are you, sir?
Good. I'll try to make my little spiel quick because I really want the feedback from it. Brother Albright, I heard you hit on a lot of points, and I'm going to try to drive them home to where I think so I can get a little bit more out of you. I work with some people that aren't here locally with me. I'm here in Virginia. But what I was going to say is a lot of people don't understand the dynamics in the South when a single family or a single source kind of controls everything when it comes to money,
yeah.
including employment and mm-hmm. decisions on the county board and all that, because they're mm-hmm. all relatives. And basically mm-hmm. what I'm saying to you is most people don't understand slave plantations are still operating and they control right. every dynamic. And what we're finding out, where I'm going to tie this into, is what I found out slowly after about 3 years of working with people and listening to the complaints from California to Oklahoma, Texas, that this Democratic Party has failed us in a lot of ways, and the black representatives have too, because you talked mm-hmm. about the money. And what I found out is, for example, I'll give you an idea. I found out in California, there's a single source for the signs for campaign season. In other words, mm-hmm. the Democrats have given people territory, like they're selling phones or Hoover vacuum cleaners like they did when I was a kid. I'm 65. So that's mm-hmm. a way of controlling the money and doing exactly what you're talking about. You're not building a solid, politically informed and savvy group of people. You're just keeping people dangling enough to come and cast a vote. And what that right. does is it doesn't disrupt the power structure in these little cocoons in towns like all through Alabama, Georgia. I used to do HUD projects, and I saw this. I've talked on this program a couple times about it. I go in there doing a HUD project and find out this local guy runs everything, and he's going to tell me how I'm going to run the project. And then I got to fight with him and tell, hold on, wait a minute. This is how the contract is. And then what's he do? He goes and get his Negro. I'll tell you my personal bias. I think the biggest problem with us is not really a white supremacy. It's meritorious manumission that the white man came up with in 1710. You find those mm-hmm. one or two Negroes that you kind of give them enough so they can live just above the others. And then they do what you're kind of talking about. There's that one person that's been known for 40 years as the go-to family that runs the politics. And when you come in with something that's going to disrupt their money source, it's not just the ideas they're trying to fight you for. It's their money. It's their revenue. They know if you, and I know you run across that. But what I was going to say to you is I get upset because I try to tell people, like here, I got Bobby Scott that's been here in my district for a long time. I tell people, you shouldn't be begging the Democratic Party. You should be on his case, and he make the Democratic Party send you some money. And the reason I'm saying that is because then you get to do, like Grace Lee Boggs talks about, you get to do that political education all year round. So then right. your politics becomes inclusive, and they know what the county recorder does. They know what the city manager does. They know, and then they're attached to it and can find out what they can get. And that's what the Democratic Party has done to us. They've cut off the money, and some of these gatekeepers in the CBC and all of that are part and parcel of that. They're not trying to build an infrastructure of younger people to take the mantle. They're trying to stay there as long as they can and keep you out. And if you can kind of touch on that, because I know you got the expertise, how to change the dynamic to teach people how to fight back, because I don't think they really understand the power in having this digital age. That if you start getting on these people's case, and I tell you, I started about 9 months ago putting pressure on Terry Sewell over hookworms down in Loudoun County. And I stayed on her so much because I kept hitting her on Twitter, and she got ready to block me. And when she blocked me, I sent her the information about the president's account. You are a public servant. even though I'm not in your district. You are a public servant. You don't get to block your Twitter. It's not yours.
Right.
So you got to let me advocate. What ends up happening, from what I understand now, she's come up with a thing where they got $12 million that they'd appropriated from the federal government. Now they got to find the matching funds locally and all of that. And I know the dynamics with that. I don't think she's working hard enough to pressure local people because she needs them to help her win again on the next round. So if you can talk about that, if possible. Thank you.
Thank you for your call.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. I don't know which part to... I think, you know, speaking about how to fight back, you know, I think part of what the caller was talking about, and thank you for the call, I think was, you know, about, you know, getting folks to see how it is that they can fight back, how they can use these pressure points on their local effect, not just local, even their congressional officials to get them to do right, to get them to use the resources. And that's a big part of what we talk about through our work with Black Voters Matter, which is it's not just about, you know, election day. It's not just about winning a particular office, but it's also about how we're holding folks accountable once they're in that office, right? And, you know, how are we, you know, tracking, you know, votes that they're doing on pieces of legislation, whether or not they're even offering and sponsoring or co-sponsoring legislation that moves our issue forward, how it is that they're taking advantage of some of the resources, like you were saying, trying to get your congressperson to deal with a health issue in somewhere in the district. And so how it is that they're tapping into resources. So that whole area of accountability is an issue that we've all got to get stronger on, right? In terms of how we track and monitor and then effectively communicate with these folks. That's one of the things that Indivisible did really well. The group Indivisible, you know, after the 2016 election, was that they, you know, really tried to educate people on how do folks take advantage of this process of how you communicate with Congress people. Like, what's the messaging? What are the buzzwords that you need to put in an email or in a phone call and all that stuff? And so all of that is stuff that we try to talk about with our partners, you know, after Election Day, as we're trying to figure out how do we hold folks accountable. Of course, the other piece of that is how do we define a community agenda ahead of time, and then we have candidates running on that agenda, so mm-hmm. the whole accountability yes. piece isn't so reactionary. It's not that we're having to force somebody
yes.
to be accountable to, you know, what we want to see, but it's that we already had developed the agenda, and even the persons that running for these offices are coming out of that process, and so it becomes a more organic way of accountability, because they're very much a part of the process that even created the agenda, instead of us having to force an agenda on mm-hmm. them and making sure that they do right. So yeah, the accountability piece is huge.
You know, if I can, and this is one of my abstract questions to you, and looking at counties, and you see the counties in the South that you've been working with and understand the process in general, what would you say is if it was a body that could start out, what would be the political position that they should direct for a cultivated candidate to go to in a county mechanism? You gave the example of the contest with sheriffs, and you know, as a electoral contest within a county. What do you see as not the black? You know, what would be a office that would be a low hanging fruit, if you may? In a county?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not sure I have a standard answer, because it kind of depends on the community and what the issues are that they're dealing with that they feel are most pressing at the time. So in some communities, I'll give an example. We were in one of the communities we were in Florida, in Pensacola. You know, they were dealing with an issue where they had just lost control of a particular seat on their board of education. And there was a lot of passion around that seat because of some educational issues that were going on at the time. And so at that moment, in that cycle, and given everything that was going on in the community, that board of education seat was kind of low hanging fruit that, you know, there was already some passion around. In another situation, it might be a sheriff or a DA, a prosecutor race. I really believe that, you know, that county commission seats, particularly in rural counties, are incredibly important, because they have so much access over the the funding,
okay.
right? The funding mechanism. Even to this point where those counties, like even in Birmingham, the amount of money that the county commission has dwarfs what the city itself has access to, right, in terms of their budget. And so those county commission seats can also be very critical. And so I'm not sure that there's just one answer I would give. I think it depends on the timing, right? So what seats are coming up at what point. It depends on who you already have in certain offices. Because sometimes you might have a situation where you've got two really strong people out of five, and there's that critical third seat that, you know, if you're very strategic and the timing's right, capturing that could get you a major win and it gets you control over a certain body. So I think there are different factors involved, but I think all of those seats that we've been talking about, school boards, county commissions, certainly things like DAs and sheriffs, because they have so much sway over the criminal justice system. I think all of those are seats that we've really got to start taking a close look at.
Thank you.
We got about six more minutes with our guests. Let's take another call. Let's go to 440. Are you there?
Hello?
Yes.
Yes. How are you doing tonight?
Great.
Okay, I just have a short question for your guest.
Okay.
And I'll take my answer off the air. How do you describe the interaction between the business communities and the voters? Like, in, you know, I know the business community are our people, but how do you see the business, you know, just general black businesses in their backing of a lot of these movements that our people are going through? And thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thank you, brother, for your call.
Yeah, you know, we've seen a mixture. I mean, we've seen, even in this past election cycle, we've seen black businesses very independent-minded, not afraid to get involved and to support. You know, so we've had some situations where we had businesses that provided space for different activities. Even with our bus tour, you know, there were some businesses that were glad to host events, right? And they weren't afraid to have the Blackest Bus in America be in their parking lot, right? And to be associated with that kind of activity. So we've seen that, which is in the fine tradition of, you know, folks like A.G. Gasson, who in Birmingham supported a lot of the civil rights movement at that time, right, with his businesses. So we've seen a little bit of that. But then we've seen the flip side, right, where you've got black businesses that, you know, they're afraid of losing support, of looking like they're too radical, of having a local bank which maybe controls their business loan or something like that, you know, for whatever the reasons are. And sometimes it's not even that. Sometimes it's not the fear and coercion piece. Sometimes it's just because, and, you know, I hate to say it, that sometimes we just have black business owners that, you know, they've been trained a certain way and think a certain way, and they just don't want to be involved, right? Because, you know, all they see is the green and not the, you know, not the, the political piece. And so we've seen both. And I don't know if I can really say that it's really been tilted one to another. It's been kind of equal, but that's, again, that's something which in the tradition of our movements, as I said, the voting rights movement doesn't happen without black farmers that are independent and willing to fund and be associated with that movement. Same thing with the civil rights movement in Birmingham. And so that's an area that we really have to put some work in. How do we pull together the business interests, the church community,
yes,
you know, yes, the fraternal sororities and all that, organizations? You know, how do we pull all of these elements together to really support this movement? And I have to say, that's one of the things that I think we had some success with during this election cycle, where there was kind of an energy where everybody kind of felt like there was possibility, and everybody felt like, you know, we had a chance to be empowered in a lot of these states and counties that really had not gotten a lot of attention. Everybody kind of felt like we mattered and were able to come together. And so we saw a lot of positive that we're hoping to really build on in 2019 and beyond.
Brother Cliff, before you wind things down and leave us, how far do you guys travel to help people to organize, or if you got a some grassroots organizations that might need help to try to get people out. How far do you guys go?
You know, that's, you know, we are working on our plans right now for 2019. There's 8 states that we know that we're going to be in, and those are the same 7 that we were in last year. We're adding Louisiana, which actually has some elections coming up in just a few weeks. But we're looking at, you know, doing some work in the north. We're looking at it. We've had people in Michigan contact us, and Pennsylvania, where you all are, of course.
Where at? I'm just curious.
Actually, I was up there. Oh God, it was some point last year. I was in Pittsburgh.
Okay.
And there's some great work. And I heard you mentioning that New African Political Party. That's not who we were in touch with at the time. But there's some groups there in Pittsburgh that were doing some great, did some write-in campaigns where I think they took over like the Board of Education.
Okay.
Or something like that. So there's some really great work going on. And we've had some other people, some individuals that aren't affiliated with organizations reach out about Pittsburgh. And then we've had folks from Ohio reach out. And in Virginia, we've had several groups that have reached out. And so we're just kind of looking at, like, you know, trying to grow in a smart way. But we'll be doing some visits throughout 2019 and building some relationships. You know, we try to do, before we do anything big, we like to first really build relationships and come up and do some, you know, some small gatherings and just kind of get a feel for what the community issues are and how much of an interest there is in a community, because we don't go anywhere unless we've been invited and there's already some infrastructure to work with. So we'll definitely be in touch with you all there in Philadelphia as we're taking a close look at Pennsylvania.
Give out any information, Brother Cliff, how people can donate, how people can be involved, how they can help. The floor is yours.
Our website is Black Voters. We actually have 2 because we have a 501c4 and a 501c3. So depending on the type of support that folks want to give, if they just want to give to the general, you know, charity, capacity development work, that's our C3. But our main website is BlackVotersMatterFund.org, Black Voters with an S, MatterFund.org. We're very active on social media. The best way to catch us on social media, both Facebook and Twitter, our handles are Black Voters MTR, like Matter, Black Voters MTR, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And you can see a lot of information, a lot of videos that we've done from 2018 and posts from a lot of our partners. But website and our social media is the best way to get us.
Great. I want to thank you for your work, Brother Cliff Albright, and I'm going to be in touch with you because I do know some folks down in the Black Belt and in other areas that could definitely use your assistance.
We're always looking for partners.
I'll be in touch. Thank you, brother.
All right. Thank you.
Take care now.
All right. Take care.
Peace. Richard, before we wind up today, we've got a few more minutes. Interesting discussion with Brother Albright about the challenges trying to organize some of our people in different areas, the fear that still exists even down south, and it's a different type of fear in the north, but it's fear all the same, that we got to get beyond, and then that gatekeeper at the door, so to speak. That's a problem. You know, some folks don't want to talk about it. Some folks feel as though you can ignore them. You can't ignore these people. They do damage. And it's just like a cancer in your body. I think I've used that example before. It's like a cancer in your body. By ignoring it, it's not going to go away. It'll just spread and get worse. You got to do something about it. So in the challenges, go ahead.
And for me, Elliot, that whole thing of the, you know, you read the reports about the Democratic Party not financing, as he called it, which I agree, organic community organizations that are, you know, developing, that wish and pushing for developing true political power, in whether it be in the South, in the North, or whatever, that the party is not financing that. And for reasons we heard. And I, you know, that's getting that message across to people who are wedded to the party, like it's a religion, you know, it's, you know, you're wedded to something that saying right to your face that they're not really interested in you.
Wow. You know, it was a lot of other areas I wanted to talk with him about, but we can always get him back on the program because the work he's doing out there, I think, is great. Listen, Stokely Carmichael, Kwame Ture said, organize, organize, organize. And the brother and the sister that's with him are out there trying to organize and going through different states and running into challenges. And he tried to start an independent black party in Selma. So, wow. Mm. Richard, the struggle continues. That's all I got to say.
Yes,
but,
sir.
But we're going to win, and that's the hope. And not the hope, the light that's at the end of the tunnel.
Right.
Before we go, let me just, before I give that lineup again, let me just read that the community announcement by one of our panelists that was with us on Saturday. Sister Empress Relay with the Black Communities United, Philly Black Communities United, the Unapologetically Black Action and Grassroots Network will be holding a briefing and organizing meeting on 2/6/2019. That's Wednesday, the 6th of February, 2019, for the upcoming We the People United Social Forum coming in July 2019 in Philadelphia. We charge Genocide 21 Project, Black Human Rights Summit, and the United Nations Initiative. Also, the Free Mumia Now Symposiums and Political Prisoners Teach-Ins and Speak-Outs as part of the ongoing necessary work to fight for the freedom of our political prisoners and specifically for Mumia Abu-Jamal on his upcoming Earth Day taking place in April 2019. All interested persons are welcome to join them on Wednesday, February 6th, from 5:30 to 6:30 at Ateola Spirit First Foods Cafe, located at 310 South 48th Street in Philadelphia. The Human Rights We Charge Genocide 21 meeting is from 6:30 to 8:30. That's after the Mumia Symposium and update. So again, and before we go, I just want to give the lineup this week, Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, African Perspectives with Brother Oshi, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., always interesting conversation with Brother Oshi on African Perspectives. At 6 to 8, Acres of Diamonds with Brother Jihad Ahmed from 6 to 8 on Time for an Awakening. Afterwards, from 8 to 9, Let's Buy Black 365 Connect with Sister Nataki and Brother Talib on Tuesday. Black Reality Think Tank with Dr. William Rogers from 8 to 10 on Time for an Awakening. On Wednesday, Revive with Sister POC from 8 to 10 on Time for Awakening. On Thursday, from 7 to 8, Relationships with Joy and Troy on Time for an Awakening from 7 to 8. And Time for Awakening is back on Friday from 8 to 10. I want to thank everybody for listening to the program this evening. Lively discussion. As always, we'll be back on Friday, Lord willing, to continue on this path towards an awakening. Peace.
Peace.
If you're driving through the country on a lazy afternoon, you're watching your children playing after school, they seem to be so unaware. I know the things that they'll soon have to take care of. We've got to do something, yeah, to save the children.
game to play. Such a small part of.
Children, to save the children.